Well, it's a pleasure to be here this afternoon, and for the purposes of this recording, perhaps I can ask you first to give us your name, then we'll begin to get into it.
My name is Peter Eaves.
And we're involved in interviewing people who have worked in the grain trader and association with it. Now, I don't think that you have ever been directly involved with the grain trade.
Not directly.
But you've played a support role, and perhaps you could explain how you came to do that.
By trade, I'm a machinist, and I worked for 14 years with Woodside Brothers. Woodside Brothers were founded in 1883 by four brothers. I believe they came from Meaford. One was a machinist, one was a pattern maker, another was a molder, and the fourth one was a blacksmith. And they opened Woodside Brothers Machinist and Foundry. They were mixed up in manufacturing of grain handling equipment and...
There's the connection that we want to get at.
That's the one.
Were you trained as a machinist in England?
Yes, I was. And I came here after serving my apprenticeship. I lived in Toronto for 2 years. I didn't really like it. Toronto, I love the country. I then moved to Collingwood, the shipyard. And
really?
They shipped me up here for 6 weeks. At the time, the Alexander Henry, that was the icebreaker, broke its fluid drive. And I came up for 6 weeks to work on it and fix it. And
this would be at Port Arthur
at
Shipyard?
At Port Arthur Shipbuilding. And I never did return. I ended up getting married and buying a house and having children and grandchildren and coaching hockey and soccer. And that's how it all happened, just by 6 weeks coming up here.
So you came up via Collingwood, via the shipyard there, which of course was involved in building ships, more than repairing them, I guess.
Yes.
Building ships for the lake trade and so on.
Yeah.
I had the pleasure of visiting the Collingwood shipyard sometime in around 86 or 87, I guess, and it was being taken down by, 10 years later or so, I guess, if it lasted that long.
Yeah, that's gone now.
Completely gone now. It's all residential housing and so on. You and I were talking about the encouragement of shipping on the Great Lakes when we were driving in, and you asked about the canal at Sault Ste. Marie, and I was saying the American Canal was opened in 1854, the Northern Railway out of Toronto to, I think it was Owen Sound, was actually finished in 1855, so from that point onwards, it was relatively easy to make that same kind of journey by Owen Sound rather than Collingwood, up to the lakehead by train and by ship. So you got here, when did you arrive in Thunder Bay, or when did you say come up for that particular job?
I would say I got here in about 1975.
75.
I came to Canada in 71.
Okay.
And after a short while after after the Alexander Henry job, I actually went to Edmonton for 6 months and worked for the Racing Company of Canada.
Which company?
The Racing Company of Canada, and the race car driver at that time was Gilles Villeneuve, Jacques' father, little French guy.
Yeah.
And then after
a very, very good racer.
A very good racer.
Son's mixed career.
And after he'd finished the season in Canada, he then joined Formula One with Ferrari, and then, of course, a couple of years later, he was killed practicing for the...
Belgium.
Yeah, Belgium Grand Prix.
Mm-hmm. A shame. Tragedy.
Anyhow, then I returned to Thunder Bay and I joined Woodside's,
right.
And that's how
and
we...
So you worked for Woodside Foundry then for something like 76 through 88, roughly?
Somewhere around there.
Roughly that period of time.
Somewhere around there.
Well, what kind of work did you do? Maybe you could describe the Woodside operation as you found it in... the mid or after the middle of the 1970s. It was better than 90 years old by that time.
Woodside's had some very, very old machinery. But it worked very, very well. And they had a niche in what they did. They had a foundry where they cast things, and the machine shop, and they had a blacksmith shop. We used to do all kinds of things for the grain industry. An awful lot of head pulleys, and pulleys that the belts ran on that delivered the grain. We used to replace the journals, the shafts in the pulleys. The shafts would actually wear out. And the reason why they wore out was the pulleys did not run on bearings as we know them. They ran on what is known as a babbitt bearing. And babbitt is lead and tin and zinc mixed. And the reason they ran on babbitt instead of regular modern bearings as we know them,
rotor bearings or ball bearings,
is that they ran so slow and greased that if a bearing failed, if a modern bearing failed, you could have it heating up and sparking. And they didn't want any of that near grain dust for explosions and stuff. So we'd replace many, many head pulleys and tail pulleys and rebab it and bore out the bearings and make the bearings to suit. Also, heaven knows how many times they would destroy the equipment that actually dumped the grain cars. And then we'd work round the clock to get them back up and operating, because if they were busy, they had to dump cars.
Did this involve your going to the elevator?
Sometimes it did. Yes, it did. And also in winter, when the shipping season stopped, they would take down the high spouts, the spouts that the grain came out of onto the boat, and we would refurbish all them. And those spouts look pretty big when you look at them on an elevator. They're even bigger when you're standing next to them, I'll tell you.
Now, I've been told, or we have been told in the course of an earlier interview, that they would be turned each year. They'd run down one face and then turn it, 180 degrees, and run down the, what would have been up.
Okay.
And then there'd be two more seasons of it, turning them both ways. So that eventually they'd be in danger of wearing through. Now, did you observe?
Yeah, they will. The grain will wear the tubes out.
Yeah.
Our part was mainly the top part where it pivoted.
Oh yes.
It was. They'd be about 3 or 4 foot round, and they had grooves in, and they were loaded with ball bearings, and that's how they pivoted out.
Right.
And through wear and tear and weather, in the end, the ball bearings would rust, and they would get pitted, and we'd have to resurface everything to get everything so that it ran correctly again.
And so that was. Were there other kinds of work that you did as a machinist?
We also built the Woodside grain sampler, which is used all over the world. It's an automatic sampling machine, and as the grain goes along the belt, it also drives a little wheel which drove little cups, we'll call them, that occasionally they'd go around slowly and then take a peck of grain or something and tip it and it went down to the side, and the inspectors would come along and take the samples to grade it, I guess.
And this was a Woodside?
It was a Woodside invention. The simplest invention I've ever seen in the world. And they made thousands of these things.
Really?
Yeah, we've shipped them all over the States and all over the world.
I don't suppose they were actually patented, or was there a
They
patent?
Were at one time.
Yeah, patent would have expired, People were content to buy them from a good supplier.
Yeah. And we used to make the little aluminum buckets and we'd ship them away to customers, and it was remarkable. I think it was actually Art Woodside who invented that. That was the son of one of the Forwardside brothers, and he took over the company. I never actually worked for Art Woodside, but I knew him. And when I joined the company, it had been taken over by Stuart Barrett and Bob Newsom. And Stuart Barrett had just died a month before I joined. Actually, Art Woodside, he died in 1996 at the age of 104. And he was in magnificent condition. How he died, I don't know. I guess he just wore out in the end. But he did actually have a heart attack in his early 90s, and they took his driver's license. And he was having no part of that, so he went and reset the test and got it back. And he lived in Red Lake, Kochner.
Oh, yes.
And his daughter was married to Ed Folgren.
Oh,
who did?
EJ.
He was part of the mining industry, and he wrote that.
He became the second commissioner.
Yes.
Commission of the Northern Environment.
That's right. That's right. Correct.
Folgren had a Woodside.
Yeah.
Well, that would just explain the Red Lake connection as well.
Yeah, Red Lake, Kochner.
Folgren was from up there, wasn't he? Art Woodside would have been born in 1892, I guess.
I guess.
He would have been.
Yes, he was under. The funeral was actually at your church at St. Paul's.
Well.
The urn that he was in was cast at Woodside's. It was made of brass. Yeah, I remember.
So Woodside was still in operation then in 1996. Clearly, if the urn was cast for that purpose, in terms of how long the operation actually lasted.
Bob finally closed the place because most of the guys were retiring, and his son didn't want to continue the business. And he did a little work himself down then, but then there was a fire, and I believe it was finally demolished in 1997, 1998, somewhere around
there.
Very
soon after Woodside's death.
Yeah, it was finally demolished.
How large a workforce would you have experienced there? How many of you were working there?
About, there'd be one welder, four guys in the foundry, and between, at the most, sometimes there were eight machinists, but I'd say basically five.
That's about 10.
Yeah, 10 employees altogether.
Right. Yeah. It's one of the places I do have a memory of, because I
you did stick your head
through
in.
The meat
yeah.
machine shop one day in order to spend a couple of hours in the foundry.
Yes. Were they pouring?
With the pouring, yes. Yeah. So we'll want to talk about that, obviously. But I'm sure you were there that day, and I'm trying to remember whether must have been early 90s, I think.
I would think so.
Yeah. In the first half dozen years, I would probably, having been MP, I had learned to be a little pushier about visiting places that I might have been earlier. And I don't remember exactly how I got in there, but it was very interesting to see the place it worked.
They've cast many things. All the cannons at Old Fort William were made at Woodside.
You've worked in the foundry, or
when they were about once a week or once every 10 days, they would pour iron, and then Eddie Skavinsky and I would go and help them.
Sure. Why don't you describe the whole process? Remind me of what I saw that day, rather than my beginning to talk about it.
There was a very old blast furnace, and you'd load it with maybe 300-400 pounds of coke, and it would be lit, and there was four stair blowing through it to get the coke burning really well. And up the chimney, there was, at the top, halfway up the chimney, there was a big gas flame, and that burnt off any pollution sort of thing. And then you would load in however much iron you needed, scrap iron that was broken up, that was bought at Lakehead Scrap. It could have been old car motors or whatever. And after about an hour, it would melt, and you could see, look into the furnace through a little peephole, and you'd know how it was. And then they would, the furnace itself, the spout would be plugged with clay. And the clay, of course, dried immediately with the heat. And they would break out the clay, and it would, the iron would run down the spout into a great big ladle that held maybe 500-600 pounds, whatever. And after the ladle had filled, you then had a big stick with another lump of clay on, and you had to push it in the hole. And
on the furnace?
Yeah, on the furnace. And you better not miss, otherwise there was iron pouring everywhere. And then they'd lift the ladle up and take it off to the moulds. And the moulds
were... It was held up by...
Yes.
The beams
a big beam.
Ceiling.
Yes, a big beam. And a ratchet.
Lord,
yeah.
Ratchet
that would move it out or back. And there'd be
two guys
and one guy...
Pouring it.
Would be getting the impurities off the top so that it went down in. And it would go into sand moulds. And they were the shape... the molds were, first of all, let us say that we were making a train wheel. The first thing we would do is we would make a wheel out of wood. That was the pattern. And it would be 2 feet was going to end up at 2 feet diameter, the wooden wheel would be made at 2 feet and half an inch, quarter of an inch per foot, to allow for shrinkage when the iron cooled down. And the wood would be white pine. One, because it was light and easy to machine, and two, when it was in the sand, which was damp but not wet.
My memory is of
wooden boxes
on the floor with this wet sand in each of these boxes.
Yeah, they would put a box down and they would put sand in, and then the wheel would go on. And then another box would go on, and sand would be put on that, and it would be packed down, and then it would be turned over.
Very carefully, I
suppose. Very carefully with clamps on, and then smoothed off where half the wheel was, and then flour would be sprinkled on top, regular cooking flour, and then the top would be put on, and it would be rammed up again of sand, and then it would be split in half, and the wooden pattern would be taken out, and then a bead about half an inch of flour would be put all around the outside of the where the void was that the iron was going in, and the other one would be put on top. And now you had, your wheel was just a space in the sand. And the flour was there in case there were any leaks, it would cut and seal it. And then they would pour the iron in, and it would fill up, and it would come up a thing called a riser, which is where the iron went in. And after it had set, after an hour or two, you would break the boxes open, and there'd be the wheel there, and it would be all encased in sand, and you'd put it in. You'd cut off the riser, which is the piece where the iron was poured in, and then you would put it in a big drum and let it tumble around with other parts, other wheels, and there was also wood blocks in there too. And so it took all the sand off. And
the drum that was motor driven, I suppose.
Yes, yes.
Like a rock tumbling.
Yes, device. Exactly. Like a giant rock tumbler. And then it would be taken out, and then it would be machined to specifications as required.
And I suppose a railway, a car wheel, is about as complex a molding as you made.
There were some very complex. The corner bearings are about 6 feet by 8 feet, and they would weigh a couple of tons.
What bearings?
And they were used in as part of the dumping operation in dumping the boxcars.
I see.
And nickel would be put in the furnace as well to give it strength.
Alloy.
Iron itself can be quite brittle and break, but if you put nickel in, it really toughens it up, and it wears a lot better.
Yeah. Because I saw some much simpler things being poured the day I was there.
Well, of course, everybody has seen all the woodside manhole covers all over Thunder Bay.
Were those also made with the two-section molds?
Yes.
It seemed to me that some of the molds were simply open to the air. The iron was poured into them. What would that be? Or am I misremembering that?
I can't see them being open.
They were all closed up, perhaps for the actual.
I've actually got a Super 8 movie somewhere of it.
Do you?
Yes, I'll have to see if I can find it.
Yeah,
I was thinking about that the other day. I'll let you have it, and you can look at.
Oh, and there's wanting to say something.
You can convert that to disc.
One could, I'm sure, convert the.
Okay. I'll have a look for it, and.
I have a set of slides somewhere or other, which I took that afternoon as well, which we could put together with the 8mm in order to enhance the visuals. So I've often said that the blast furnace itself was an old locomotive boiler.
It could have been. It could very well have been.
You know, you couldn't.
I can't remember.
And I
as such, it.
It was about that size, wasn't it? The width of the.
Yeah. You could stand up inside it easily.
Could you?
Yes. And every year you'd have to reline it with bricks.
Yes, that's the fire thing, bricks. Isn't it? The fire brick that has to be inside it. It's one of those fundamental aspects of the industrial era, I suppose. A foundry, the furnace that melts iron, and so on and so forth. Africa, they were made in East Africa 150, 200, whatever, maybe 2,000 years ago. You know, furnaces of 8 or 10 feet high or whatever were apparently made, and iron was smelted there by African people. These things were found in the colonial era, and people marveled at first to what was this. The Africans themselves, they had forgotten that their ancestors had done this work, that there was the physical remains, and that's no doubt that they had been smelting iron.
When they when iron is originally made in the first place, using the limestone and everything else, and they refer to it as pig iron. Well, the reason they refer to it as pig iron is because when it runs off, it runs down all little troughs, and it goes into little blocks, and it looks like a pig with the little pigs feeding on the mother. That's where they got the name pig iron.
And of course, the pig iron then would be
further refined, and
in this case, of course, it was these castings themselves that were the product of the foundry.
Yeah, one of the first recyclers, I guess, besides old iron into new iron.
That's very true. It is, in fact, a quintessential process. The Woodside Foundry wasn't the only one in town.
No, there was one at the shipyard, and that's gone now. That got knocked down.
So there isn't one left in town anymore?
There's none in town. I believe there's one in Winnipeg.
Well, it could be very interesting if you want ornamental castings, plaques and that sort of stuff, as I became involved with obtaining one for the Coalition for Waverly Park. We ended up, in this case, of course, it was a, what did it be, bronze. We ended up in Pittsburgh.
In Pittsburgh?
That's where the foundry was that took the order and cast the result and so on and so forth.
And was it expensive?
Not all that expensive, no.
Okay.
What was the, what did you do with the slag?
That's why we're not very environmental. We flung it out of the back roughly where pool six is.
You hauled that far away?
Well, no, it was out of the back of the building on the way to pool six. Yeah, the slag off the top was, yeah. So we did recycle, but we did do some naughty things too.
Someone's reaction when I said Woodside Foundry a day or two ago was to frown and say, what a dirty place, and so on and so forth. You may, since you sort of half opened the door to that kind of question, do you want to say something about
it? Oh, it certainly was. It was old and it was dirty, but it was very efficient in what it did in its day.
Well, the people working there were skilled, obviously.
Yeah.
Your fellow machinists similarly,
yes, and
knew what they were doing. The equipment was quite old, you were saying.
Quite old. Some of it was originally belt-driven off the roof, but they changed them over to motors, independent
steam-powered
motors. Yeah.
Initially,
of course, in 1884, Woodside's was the first place that hydro was generated in Port Arthur, and I believe that the generator is at the museum, at Thunder Bay Museum somewhere, because we got it back off them for the display on the 100th birthday.
Well, this is the thing, a business can be pioneering at one point and really make its mark, and then sort of run down in a way with not much investment going into it, I suppose. The buildings didn't look as if there was any money being plowed back. The machinery was kept up.
Yes. In fact, one of the biggest, biggest lathe there was taken in payment because of default on the PD Railroad.
Oh, really?
When was that? When was the...
Well, there's a book that pulls it all together very nicely, but the PD is before the First World War, I think the late 19th century. As a matter of fact, yes, of course, because when the Canadian Northern, Mackenzie and Mann, were building into the lakehead about 1903, I think, or was it even earlier than that, the turn of the century, the 1900, yeah, they opened through the Rainy River Valley on New Year's Day 01, as I remember now. I had to know this for another connection altogether. And they took over the right of way, part of the right of way, and used the PD, so it would be the 1890s that.
Okay.
And so they lost, or they acquired it.
We acquired it, and I actually ran it, and it ran very well. It made a hell of a noise, but it did the job.
Yeah.
I only ran it once, I think, but.
Many people who will be listening to your description of things will have no idea what a machinist actually does. You mentioned a lathe, but you could specify what part of your work that was. Tell us about what a machinist would be trained to do.
We would make something out of raw stock metal, which, for example, could be a motor shaft. You would cut the metal to a set size, which would be within half a thousandth of an inch at least. For bearing fits, you need about half a thou to three quarters of a thou tight, and what you do is you heat the bearings up to put them on. keyways, milling machines, grinders, shapers.
Keyways, if there were, for example, on a shaft.
If something was being driven, a gear went on it, there would be a square key which was cut in the gear and in the shaft.
So the little hole in the gear would have half of the
half
square.
Half a square,
and
the shaft would be,
the other half that you
And it would be set screwed on or shrunk on. Or possibly a slide on, and then a taper key, which is known as a gib key, could be used. Flat surfaces, motor bases, machine parts for the spouts, for the grain elevators, pulleys, boring them out.
The variety of machinery, you began with a lathe, and here's something that spins. I guess the
yes.
simplest way for many people to think of it would be, let's just say,
a milling,
a
milling machine,
hat.
A lathe, in a lathe, the work spins, the tool stays still.
Right.
In a milling machine, the work stays still, the tool spins.
And the tool could have there all sorts of
it could
shapes
have, it could be for cutting a straight keyway, or it could be a big flat slab mill for flattening a surface for a motor base, or...
And various sizes of drills, I suppose.
Yeah, drills. You can also use a milling machine, offset it for line boring. That is a number of holes on the same plane going through on one piece, but there'll be different sections to it so that it perfectly lined up.
By the 70s and 80s, I suppose, a new shop would be computer-based, computer-assisted design and manufacturing, what CAM, I guess, is the kind of thing, the initials that came in. Now,
the CNC,
you never had any of that, I don't suppose.
No. Kandahar, what's it called?
Bombardier.
Bombardier has a lot of CNC machinery, an awful lot. Woodside had none. The shipyard has one small piece because the CNCs, the tape machines, are basically for making many, many pieces identical.
Yeah.
Whereas the shipyard might make one off of something and we'd make one off of something.
In fact, if one looks back at the history of fine manufacturing, if you will, although fine is what we're talking about, the machinist's capacity to take a piece of steel or metal, whatever it is, steel or other metal,
yeah,
and work that into the required shape using the machinist's own knowledge, skill, and the equipment, obviously,
yes,
it's very different from, or is, well, it's different in kind from when you have mass production, when you have interchangeable parts, when you have machinery that you can set to produce, you know, thousands of whatever, so that if someone's building the Colt revolver,
see,
every Colt revolver
yeah.
is like
yeah.
every other Colt revolver of that make.
Quite so. So CNCs are magnificent if you're doing mass production
yes.
work, and they do fine work.
In the history of manufacturing, it's about the 1850s that this becomes really clear. The great Crystal Palace exposition in London, was it 1854? It's close, the same middle of the 1850s. The Americans who brought in a lot of their equipment, you know, the revolver makers, the sewing machine makers and so
yes.
on, who were doing this interchangeable parts, mass production and so on and so forth, really quite a sound in the British at the time, because the
yeah.
British were still based in the machinist's
yeah.
skill, the each part individually
each part
made
individually
and so on and so
made.
Forth.
And if you're mass producing, it doesn't pay
no.
to have people
no.
make hundreds and hundreds of the same when you can do it automatically and with great tolerance.
Sure.
They're fantastic.
But if you're in the repair business,
You've got to,
equipment.
It's one-offs. You don't know what it's going to be.
You need the machinists and the skills. Were there any other pieces of equipment in the machine shop?
There was a great big planer, which is a machine that goes backwards and forwards, and it literally planes steel flat.
So you know about planers on wood.
Yeah.
But it strikes one as a much finer art to have that happening to a steel plate.
And as Jack Munn, who worked there, once said, he went to the Henry Ford Museum. I guess it's in Detroit, is it?
Dearborn, Michigan comes
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but it's the Detroit area, surely.
But he came back from his holidays and he said that they'd got a planer in there that was so modern he couldn't believe it compared to the one we were using. Yeah. Ours must have been 100 years older. And that had belts going in every direction. They'd go one way and then it had, as the table came back, it had flip a dog and the belt would jump over and then it would go back the other way. It must have taken somebody a lot to work out how to design such a thing in those days. But it was a magnificent piece of equipment. But, was old. It was old.
Of course, this place would be labor intensive and skill labor applied to things, and with not much investment after that initial one that the four brothers originally had sunk into it to establish parts of it.
Newsom and Bob did bring stuff along, but in the end, Bob saw that his son wasn't interested and he was going to have to close it, so he basically ran it till it was done. And in fact, some of the equipment, actually, a couple of the lathes were bought by Big Pines Trailers on Cumberland Street, and they just use them for making sometimes axles. When people break axles on the trailers or boat trailers or whatever.
So those machines are still at Big Pines?
As far as I know, there's two of them. There's a South Bend lathe and a Wilson lathe. I don't know where the rest of now I do. Either Bruno or Hackwell bought some of the other equipment just for doing repairs on their own equipment in their shop, wherever it is.
So most of it didn't actually get recycled.
Yeah, and I guess the stuff that didn't went to the scrapyard and got turned into something else. Was shipped out as scrap and melted down and cast as something else.
Is there anything else in the machine shop that you might want to describe? You mentioned that there was also a blacksmith shop, of course.
Yes.
Now, what would a blacksmith shop do between, on the one hand, the foundry over there and the machine? I mean, blacksmith's work is on a much smaller scale. I can't think.
Yeah.
My father did some.
We never had a blacksmith while I was there. But
superseded what, by welding?
The thing about forging things is, in a foundry you cast things in brass, aluminum, or iron. In a blacksmith shop, you get the steel red hot or hotter, and you beat it with a hammer or with devices. And the advantage is that in steel, like wood, there is a grain. And as you forge it, the grain stays. It gives strength. Rather than machining something, when you machine something, the grain is cut. It's just like cutting a piece of wood and around. And so the grain is cut wherever you are. If you forge it, the grain flows as you bend the metal and it adds strength. That's why snap-on wrenches are all drop forged. They're not machined.
Right.
They are machined, and the final little bit to make them shiny and the tolerances. But basically, they are drop forged.
Now, what does that actually mean in the making?
A drop forging is where you have a piece of metal that's red hot, and you put it on a shape of what you want it to be, and a press comes down and smashes it into that shape, and then it may go to another one that makes it a bit better, and then the third one will cut the flashing off, and then they'll let it cool down, and then they'll deal with it from as they will.
So this is the question initially would be, of course, the quality of the steel itself,
yeah,
when it's going to be so treated, and then it's a matter of those hydraulic presses, I guess they are.
You can actually see them making snap-on wrenches on, is it Channel 37? How is it made?
Yeah,
yes, I've seen them do it on there.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting.
Well, yeah, I guess for the economic and environmental historian, maybe the Krupp works in the Ruhr Valley of Germany.
Krupps?
In the 1860s and 70s, they make huge cannons and things, but they had these...
From penknives to battleships, the Krupps.
Huge pieces of equipment that were doing exactly that. At that point, I wonder, would they be hydraulic, actually, or would they be depending on the sheer weight of the thing coming down? Terms of the drop,
it could be on a cam formation to make the press roll, or it could be hydraulic or pneumatic. Or
I'm actually very hazy on hydraulic power. How that the use of oil under pressure? How hydraulic technology developed? Do you know anything about
that? Hydraulic cylinders are very strong. As you can see. On a backhoe or on a bulldozer.
But I wonder who first came up with the idea of the
The guy to talk about hydraulic motors is Peter Stevenson.
Yeah,
he spent his whole life with hydraulic.
Well,
though he was talking to you about the grain and the dust.
Yes. Well,
did he tell you about the rats at Patterson Elevator? No, I meant. I thought Peter would have told you the story that I don't know what he was doing. He was up Patterson Elevator, and something fell off the roof and ended up on the riverbank. And the guy sent him down to get it, and he got down and got the piece. And then he's trying to come up the riverbank, and he said there were hundreds and hundreds of eyes looking at him out of the holes in the back. I thought Peter Stevenson would have told it. He tells the story better than me. You'll have to ask him about all the rats.
Forgot to tell us about the inhabitants of the Patterson Elevator area, then, four leggeds.
Yes, yes. Not the people rats, these were rat rats,
real
rats.
Oh, yeah, they're quite.
Yes.
We're using the Patterson Foundation money for this project. So
are you? Oh.
Robert Patterson and his family are estimable.
Oh, I did. Well, I will say one thing about the Pattersons. They have now put a resuscitator in every arena in Thunder Bay.
Splendid.
And there's one at our arena in Current
Splendid
River, and
idea.
I think it's magnificent.
Splendid idea.
Yes.
Peter did say something about bashing through the walls, I think, of the various elevators to put lines through. That was Peter, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The Patterson elevator was easier to get through than some of the others. And we didn't draw the conclusions. Obviously, it would be a reflection of the builders, not the owners, to do that. where were we? We were talking about drop forging.
And
about hydraulic power and things of that sort. As you were saying, there wasn't actually a blacksmith.
That
function had really been superseded by.
The last blacksmith I remember was he retired in about 1978, and he worked at Port Arthur Shipyard.
After that?
And then or, they or never retired. Had one. Before then, they always had blacksmiths.
Yeah.
And the last one retired, and I guess there are no more.
I think that the welders.
Now fabricating to a certain extent
instead of the work. My father actually exemplified some of that. I think he learned blacksmithing from a blacksmith in Winkler, Manitoba in the late 30s.
Okay.
And he had a small forge on the farm and so on and so forth. You crank it up, make it steel, make it red, and there was a big anvil and a hammer, so on and so forth to fix things. He did a lot of those things, but he was very pleased sometime in the 50s to acquire the first welder, which I think was an airplane generator that had been converted by Princess Otto and Machine in Winnipeg to be used as a welder to generate the electric welding, obviously. And my dad got to be very good with that. And by 1970, he had a machine shop in Carmen, Manitoba, the last 5 working years of his life. Running that with various kinds of machines on a much more modest scale, obviously, than you were working with.
What were they doing? Mainly farm equipment?
Farm and Department of Highways, government, think highways in particular, when there were repairs to be made. But it was the farmers he was serving as well. He loved to give them a good deal and undercut his competition in the process, I guess. But a farmer to start was the farmer's sign. Was there anything else at Woodside then? We've talked about the machine shop and the foundry, and I recognize the blacksmith function was gone. Who was the fourth of the brothers that you described coming up? They were a nice set of skills.
One was a machinist, one was a founder, one was a blacksmith, and one was a pattern maker, which is basically a machinist, but he made everything in wood. He made all the patterns that... whatever you wanted to make in iron, he made it in wood first.
And that's a very interesting point to make, because lay people hearing pattern making are likely to think of paper, I would guess, as the pattern, particularly those who have watched their mothers sewing clothing.
Yeah.
There's the buttering or whatever it happens to be company. The package of the paper pattern, but in this case, pattern making in a foundry is quite a different skill. You've already described,
yes.
Of course, the way in which the white pint would be worked and so on.
In fact, Bob Newsom, the owner, used to make any new patterns for the foundry.
Because you'd have an inventory of old ones.
There were literally thousands and thousands of wooden patterns in Woodside's up in the second building. They could be gears from 3 inches diameter to 6 feet diameter gears, either for the mining industry, or there would be wooden patterns for the where they shovel the coke onto the boats for the engines, the coal-fired boats. We had the wooden patterns for the boilers for them, for ships that sank 60, 80 years ago. I think a lot of the patterns that we used to still use went back to whoever needed them, be it United Grain Growers or Saskatchewan Pool or whatever. But a lot of the other patterns, I believe, went to Thunder Bay Museum.
So there wasn't a glorious fire, because these things would burn well.
The fire mainly was, I believe, in the machine shop and office part. And all the patterns were returned to whoever had paid for them in the first place, whichever company we manufactured them for, or were sent to Thunder Bay Museum.
Was the inventory of the patterns quite well kept up? I mean, when you've got thousands of them, or were they lined up by size?
Newsom knew where they were. Nobody else knew anything. I'd be up there for days looking for stuff if he'd be on holiday, and I'd be trying to find things. And But he knew where it was, but he never told anybody. It was all in his head.
How long had he worked there?
Bob Newsom was in the Navy in the war, and after the war...
In the engine room, I suppose.
I really don't know what Bob did in the Navy. And after the war, he was the machinist, the one machinist for the elevator in Churchill. And him and Margaret lived up there, and then Margaret became pregnant with Ronnie, their first son. They had a son and a daughter. And he decided then to return to Thunder Bay. And he had a friend called Stuart Barrett, and they both worked for Art Woodside, the old gentleman that died. And Art wanted to retire, so they bought the business off Art.
Right. So they'd worked there for some time, and suppose he added to the pattern, so had a sense of what was where. But there wasn't a fine inventory.
It was wherever it landed, but he knew where it landed when he threw it. So.
Right.
And Bob died a few years ago. I went to his funeral. Yeah. His wife is still alive, Margaret. Oh, yeah. And I believe Ronnie lives in Whitehorse.
Further north still. Yeah.
He actually owns the concrete company up there.
Yeah, no, there's another industrial function, if you will, turning Portland cement into good concrete.
Yes, he
very
owns
extreme.
The
I was looking at a book on bridge building the other evening, and fascinating. Anyway, were there any other sections of the Woodside Foundry that we haven't yet talked about?
I can't think of any offhand.
Yeah. It was quite an institution, that quite a business.
Yes.
In its day.
Who did the paperwork?
The office work? Mm-hmm. Margaret, Bob's wife. Yeah, she looked after payroll, she looked after billing. I actually got out the day book of sales for 1968. I had it on my dresser this morning, and I meant to bring it, and I forgot it. Because I said, can I have it? And they said, yes. When the place closed, I was down there, and I took a couple of wooden pounds, and they gave me the day book for 1968, I don't know. But it was 1968, the day book of all the work that went through, and how much people were charged. And it was quite amazing. You know, the Chronicle Journal, $11.50. I don't think you'd get away with that in these days.
Given what else is at the museum, maybe at some point you'll be depositing the book as well at the museum?
Well, I might give them the book.
Some distant day. Write it into your will, what's to be done with it.
So I guess I should look for that Super 8 movie.
It would be very interesting. Well, let's, we've had an interesting, you've done a great job of sketching. People who don't remember, or who weren't around, or whatever, the Woodside Foundry was on the waterfront, south of where Marina Park and the yachting area and so on is now. It was between the road to the Pool 6 elevator, now extinct, between that road and the railway track, wasn't it?
Yes.
Did it actually have a railway spur line in or not?
No, it didn't. There was a split in the rail line, but we were on the lake side of it.
Yeah.
Would have been basically north of where the second, the second part of the marina is going to go, where they're going to dredge and put the second, the boats that have been displaced by the building out.
We're across the railway tracks from, the Andrus Apartments, or were you?
And the co-operators used to be there. And the Chronicle Journal.
And the Chronicle Journal is further north.
And there were innumerable bars on
Cumberland.
But I can't, the Vendome maybe, I don't know these. They closed by the time.
In 1885, downtown Port Arthur had over 40 hotels and public houses.
Did it?
Yes. Downtown Port Arthur was busier in 1885, I would wager, than at any point since then, or certainly in our day.
The only old one that I remember and I've been in was the Mariachi.
Oh, yes. Yeah, the hotel.
And I actually went to the closing night. They had a function there. And I ended up sitting with Lawrence Timko.
Oh,
and Lawrence had had too much. But maybe that's the only night in his life. But Lawrence had had too much. I'd had too much, and Lawrence had had more than me.
Talking about artifacts, although Lawrence is running again, isn't he?
Yes, Lawrence is running again.
Never at large. What would you like people to know about the work that you did and the places you worked?
I would. A lot of people know me. I would like to think, as the job itself, that I was very good at what I did. I would like to think that it might sound a bit corny, that any parts I made helped in some way the development of Thunder Bay.
Or the successful operation of the grain trade.
Yes, the grain trade, or any part that whatever I did helped in some way.
Yeah, yeah.
The growth of Thunder Bay or the development of Thunder Bay. Or
what might surprise people most about the work that you did, or interest them, if that's a surprise is too strong a word?
One thing that would surprise them is the strange hours. You regularly get called at 2 o'clock in the morning. As soon as something breaks, after the boss is the first one that gets called, you're the second one that gets called because you've got to fix it. Morning, noon, night, Saturdays, Sundays, holidays.
You had a regular work week.
Yes. We worked from 8 to 4:30. Monday through Friday.
That's an eight-hour day.
Eight-hour day, 40-hour week. But the number of times that Eddie Skavinsky and I have worked round the clock, or round the clock 1.5 times, and it always seemed to be when the grain dumping operation went down.
Yes.
The dumper shafts broke, or got bent, or somebody decided to pull the grain cars into the shed with the engine still attached to the other end with the brakes on. Everything would be torn apart and then all hell would break loose.
So you have seen some real disasters in the elevators.
Oh, I've seen some great ones. I think the best one was, I don't know if I've got my figures right, but you can back 17 grain cars onto Richardson's dumper, and I have seen them back 19 of them. Two went straight in the lake, right off the end. That's a mess.
I've been in that elevator actually, so I can picture that.
I don't know how many times they did it. I guess they never learned. The number of times it was in the paper.
Which side's going to produce something that would have made it a little more difficult to do that?
Well, we did also cast the things, the buffers for the wheels, and of course we did cast all the dock bollards for the elevators that the grain boats tie up with, the ones that the hoops go around as they bring them into berth. Yes, all those are.
I trust they compensated you well when you were called in the middle of the night. Time and a half.
We were time and a half. We were.
Yeah.
Bob was a good man to work for.
Good.
Cantankerous. guy, but he was very good.
But he'd blow it.
He only fired me four. He only fired me four times and hired me five.
He observed employment standards, I take it.
Yeah.
Well, I can certainly understand the surprising nature of that, and your good wife put up with this, not to mention the children.
Oh, yeah.
What are you most proud of, the work that you did over the years? You may practically have said that already, but contribution that you made, I suppose. If I ask
I don't think there's one item. Yeah. I'm just proud of everything I've done.
Sure. And you know that your work, you would think that your work contributed to Canada's success.
Yes.
In the grain trade. Getting those unloaders back into service.
Well, yes. I guess if you, especially the dumping systems, if you're not dumping grain cars and you're shipping grain out, sooner or later the elevator's going to go down unless you can dump cars. Yes. And apparently when the season is on, or the push is on before the freeze up, they want to get what they can out and clear of the locks and everything before freeze up or they close it.
There's always a seasonality, even today, in the grain trade.
Yeah.
Which is to say, of course, the grain doesn't move in the wintertime. It can move by train all the way to Quebec City or whatever. Was Woodside Foundry affected by seasonality and employment in the same way? Was winter a slower time for you?
No, not really. If anything, I would have thought maybe it might have been a little busier because that's when they did tear everything apart and refurbish everything ready for the next season.
Yeah.
As I was saying with the grain spouts and the dumping systems, or they'd take the pulleys out and we'd rebabbit the bearings, and we were pretty steady.
Yeah.
I was only laid off for 4 weeks once.
Really?
Yes.
Over the 12 years.
In the 12, 14 years.
Or 14 years.
Yeah. That was all.
Right. Yeah, well, that's quite a good record. A good place to work. Do you see major changes in the work that you were doing over the years? Given that there wasn't much technological change at the Woodside Foundry, I guess, or the Woodside Brothers business.
Of course, there's nowhere near the number of elevators that we used to have.
Yeah.
I mean, that is basically now I guess Dingwells or Fabmar or Fairbanks do most of the work, and possibly Peterson's machine shop.
Peterson's machine shop?
Yes, they're on Russell Street.
And that's the main operation left now, the main machine?
Peterson's, Dingwells, Fairbanks.
Okay.
Fabma are actually more marine or fabrication. They're in the East End.
Did you have a sense that the future of the Woodside business itself, if the sons had wanted to take it on or a son had wanted to, was being impacted by the slowdown in the grain trade?
Yes, I think so. That was part of the...
there was less future.
The end of... It had reached a point where it was a going concern, but it needed a great amount of money spent on it.
Sure.
And with Bob being of retirement age and his son not being interested at all, he just folded the company up.
Yes. So CAD-CAM would be all the rage, computer-assisted design and manufacturing and so on and so forth. We were talking about that earlier.
Yes.
But that would have been a complete, probably a new shop, actually.
Yeah.
I suppose. Do you know whether any of the ones you've mentioned, Peterson's, Fairbairn, and so on, are they into CAD-CAM to any extent?
Dingwells would be, and possibly Fairbairn's. Peterson's machine shop is a very, very good shop. very nice, very modern, does lots of work, but mainly one-off things, specialty stuff. For mines or, yeah.
That's the machine shop,
yeah,
essentially.
Yeah. And they do fabrication as well. But I actually did a bit of work for them about 2 years ago. They phoned me up. They had to do some vertical line boring, actually on site at, happened to be Bowater Mill.
Oh, yes.
Or as Great Lakes as I call it. And nobody knew how to run it. And one of the guys remembered that I'd run one once. And so they phoned me up and I went over there. And they said, you've got 10 days. I said, okay. Well, and we had to do it nighttime. So we had 10 days starting on a Monday. And by midnight Wednesday, I phoned him up. I said, well, it's all finished. They couldn't believe it. Yeah.
I trust they paid you for 10 days.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, they didn't. But they were quite generous, I will.
Yeah. A bit of a bonus for them.
Paul Peterson, I like him too.
Yeah, you see that shop. How long, do you know how long it's been in operation?
Peterson's?
Yes.
His father owned it. And it was first called a really strange name. It was called Det Co. And
D-E-T-C-O.
I think so. Brian Blucher worked there. And what happened was, it was quite successful, but there was a squabble amongst the owners. And Dave Peterson, and in the end it went out of business. But then Dave Peterson opened Dave Peterson's, it was Peterson's machine shop, and it did fantastically. And I guess Dave was about 50, and the secretary walked in the office one day and he was dead at his desk. And his son took over, Paul. In fact, Paul was at City Council last week making a presentation on something. And Paul kept it going. And Paul would only have been about 23 or 24 at the time. But he kept it going and he's made a great success out of it.
So this, if we wanted to pursue machine shops, Peterson's would be a good one.
Peterson's and Dingwell's and Fairburns. Fairburns is on the same street as Peterson's. I believe it's Russell Street. Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen the names without ever really having knowledge of, to connect them with. You were a machinist, a member of the International Association of Machinists?
No, I was a member of the steel workers. I've been a member of the paper makers. It doesn't make much sense, but
well, that's industrial. Yeah.
The steel workers were Woodsides, the shipyard was steel workers, and of course the provincial mill Cascades was paper worker energy and something,
sure,
whatever,
right,
until it closed.
Right, you had steel workers, and this was on the industrial.
Henry Garrow.
Henry Garrow,
yes. And I can't remember the other gentleman's name. But it was in the age of Henry Garrow.
Right.
And he's been dead a long time now.
Quite a while.
Yeah. Is his wife still alive, Holly?
I don't know. I was thinking of Holly the other day. I'm guessing that she may. She used to work at the university, as a matter of fact.
Did she?
I think. She may have remarried and left town or whatever. I'm guessing. I don't think I've seen her in years myself. And you weren't involved with the union very much, I don't suppose. So all of you at Woodsides were steel workers then?
Yes.
Right. Local, your own local? Or?
Our own local.
And so you'd be...
There was 5056 in my mind, but that could have been the shipyard number. I can't remember what the local number was.
Because you had a different local.
Yeah.
So this would be negotiating contracts and so on and so forth?
Yes, and I was the president of the local at one time. And yeah, there was a negotiation once in the office, and it was with Hedrick Garrow. And we were going after a certain amount of money, and there was no way Bob was going to pay for it. Anyhow, I got mad, and I took the office door off the frame. Anyhow, the long and the short of it was, in 48 hours, we got exactly what we wanted for a contract. But I had to pay for the office door. I wish Henry was still alive, he'd have told you the story about me taking that office door off.
You went straight through that door, I think.
Oh yeah, I opened it without turning the handle. But 2 days later, we got the race, but I had to pay for the door.
So this was another of the changes, other than change, achieving that better agreement. I don't suppose you'd have much of your thoughts about major challenges that the great industry has faced, or perhaps?
No, I know a few people who work in the grain industry now.
Yeah.
It seems rather touch and go.
Enormous change.
There basically is nobody works for them. When I came here, I forgot how many people work. 1,400?
My memory is that in 84, when I was running, that Frank Mazura was president of Lodge 650, or chair of Lodge 650, grain handlers. We talk about, I think, about 1,800.
Oh, okay.
Waterfront.
Yeah.
And if we have a tenth of that now, I think we're doing well.
Yeah, there's
enormous change of all sorts.
Yeah.
What are your most vivid memories, other than taking doors down? Vivid memories of the job you've done.
That
was it dangerous work? How dangerous was it?
No. There was one instance. I had to go and check something at Canada Malting, and it involved me using a man lift. I don't know if you've ever seen one. It's an endless belt that goes from the bottom of the elevator to the top to the bottom, and you stand on it, and it takes you up, and then you get off at the right floor, you go right over the top. I didn't like that at all. But when I did get to the top of the elevator, they said, it's down the hall, and it's the door on the right. So I went down there, pushed the bar, and I walked out. And I'm not kidding you, there was a square yard platform with no handrails and nothing at the top of the elevator. And I just backed in and sat down. I couldn't stand up for 15 minutes. My legs, I was terrified. It absolutely terrified. I don't like heights at the best of times, but I just walked through this door. There was nothing. It was that big.
So it's one door you weren't going to take out.
Yeah, and the grain spout was there, but I never thought, and I just walked out. I was terrified, absolutely terrified. I was so terrified I didn't even, I finally went down all the stairs, and I went back. I said, somebody else, I just can't do that, I can't.
Told him about the door, though.
Yeah. Well, you think at least it'd be a rail.
Yeah. It was just a platform.
And what's worse, it was expanded metal, and you could see through that as well.
There's water down below, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, a lot of good that is. I can't swim, Ernie. Mind you, if you fell off an elevator, I would think it'd be like hitting concrete.
Well, that's a pretty vivid memory. Any others?
No, except every time they did cast iron, and they'd usually finish about 3 o'clock, We always got a case of beer and sat outside the door and drank the case of beer. And as always, Bob Newsom drank more than anybody else, the owner. But I do remember
It's very hard, hot work.
Yes, it really is hot.
A fellow would really be dehydrated.
Yeah.
I'm of two minds or whatever about the rehydrated qualities of beer.
Yes, Gatorade might have been better, but it never seemed to win a vote.
What would be the temperature indoors in working environment? Temperature indoors, Fahrenheit.
In the machine shop, fine. In the foundry, it would be very hot. Very hot when iron was being poured. And very steamy, and not that healthy, I would think.
It's coming out at what, 1800 degrees?
Yeah.
Something
yeah.
of that sort?
Yeah.
And into the molds?
Into the molds and...
I think what I probably saw initially when I was there was these molds open, and then
okay, they could be open before, and then
they
put the top
on. Closed down so that I saw actually what was inside there.
Yeah,
and then the covers were put on. But I do remember the two men with the ladle and going from one mold
to another,
pouring the iron in, and so on and so forth.
Cranking the,
yeah, moving it along,
moving it along and around.
I remember that so clearly. There never was much in the way of pollution control at the place,
no.
I don't suppose.
Only in the stack itself, there was an afterburner while they were melting the iron.
Designed to reduce the emissions
yes,
in the air.
Yes, or if anything... burning went up it to get a good blast and burnt so that it didn't take off into the bush and set the waterfront on fire.
Right. I don't remember the foundrymen wearing masks or anything of that sort.
No.
No, I don't remember being offered any
no.
masks. So the, I don't know how dangerous air around a blast furnace is.
I would think it's not very healthy.
Yeah, that's probably a fair description. Places vary, I guess, lead smelting, Trail, B.C., I could, Cominco, and all those Italian workers, and the manager writing once in the 20s, what would we do without our Italian workers, working through thick and thin, smelting the lead, and so on and so forth. I don't know what their life expectancy was, but I would guess it was significantly less than that of people who...
Yeah.
They worked in the woods or whatever.
People were expendable then.
Yeah. Thomas is
before.
Wouldn't be the attitude actually being stated, but
no.
It was the case. Any workers' comp experience over the years? Were you fortunate you worked carefully as
I
well?
I did get a piece of steel in my eye, and I was off for a number of weeks. I went to see a Port Arthur clinic, I can't remember his name, Falk, Dr. Falk. And he had me down and he was looking through something at the eye and looking and he poured different dyes in my eye to see different reactions. And he said, you've got to relax, more. And
knock me out, Doc, knock me out.
So he says, I know, I'll relax. And he got this big needle. And, oh, geez, I didn't believe it. He stuck it through my eye. I thought he was going to give me an injection. He stuck it right through my eye and never told me. I nearly ripped the arms off the chair. That was Dr. Falk. Do you know him?
Yes.
Not a very good bedside manner, that doctor. Very good doctor, but I remember him sticking
he
that needle.
He built a gigantic barbecue in the 70s. I was on the receiving end of one of his pigs that he roasted on this item. But it was in the planning and fabrication stages for at least 20 years, I think, before he unveiled it. And he and a buddy of his called a gang of us together on the North Shore, and we Apparently he's still alive.
Is he?
That's what I heard. His name came up in a meeting I was at last week.
Well, George Wozdecki's still alive.
Yes.
He used to be my doctor.
It's obviously a healthy profession that people live a long time.
Yes.
Take care of themselves, I suppose. Was the steel of the eye the result of not wearing safety goggles?
Yes, it was.
And you wore them after that?
Yes, I did.
Had they been available earlier? Or
yes. Totally my fault. Whenever I've had any kind of accident that's needed me getting stitched up or anything, it's always been my fault.
Well, we can debate that at some length, couldn't we? Because the way in which a work is organized can be a factor. Maybe at the end, it is human error in many cases, but
taking shortcuts.
It is a matter of work organization.
And yeah.
That's part of that. And so the employer always bears some responsibility, I would want to assert, but of course, you're a skilled
worker. I think I can say it's because I've taken a shortcut. There's a number of times. Beer, stop that. You're going to have an accident. Okay. I've learned now. I don't heal as well as I used to.
Isn't that a fact? I didn't ask you at the beginning because it was moving along quite nicely, but what was involved in apprenticeship and becoming a machinist? This was in Old Blighty, of course.
In England, it was a 5-year apprenticeship. The first year, I didn't turn up at the company at all. I went to college.
Which college was it?
It was Keithley Technical College, which is about 8 miles west of where I live.
In Yorkshire?
Yeah, of Shipley, 8 miles. Keithley's still in Yorkshire.
Yeah.
For the first time in 50 years, they elected a Conservative yesterday.
The world is going to hell.
Yes, the world is going to hell. The first year I went to school full time. The second year, I worked at the company with some of the tradesmen there. And I also went to school once a week. On the third year, it was the same. Fourth year, the same. The fifth year, I was at work full time, but I had evening classes from about 5:30 to 9:30 twice a week. And then I sat my final exams, which was run by, I think it was called the Humberside Engineering, something in Humberside Engineering Examination Board.
Sure.
I've actually got it somewhere, and I.
It's a certificate.
Yeah. Oh yes, I've got all the certificates and all the original, the deeds of apprenticeship.
Yes.
Were about this big and about 8 pages. Who did what and how and.
Keithley, the first year in particular, would not have been all theory by any means.
No, practical and theory. Yes, they had their own machine shop. I would say it would be about a day and a half shop, 3.5 days in classrooms, and you'd we took basic electrical wiring, I don't know why, welding, plumbing. We'd never used it in the job, but it was part of the whole course.
Yeah, you needed to understand
and,
all these things.
Of course, doing blueprints, making blueprints and all.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Well, it's an important part of becoming a skilled tradesman. The tradition is, of course, to think in terms of the apprentice, the journeyman, the master. I guess that the master stage is.
I am seeing
just
that.
Really
just journeyman.
It's journeyman. Once you complete your apprenticeship, you're a journeyman. And so often that did mean exactly that, a lot of traveling around
lots
to
of
jobs,
yeah.
I'm sure. Well, are there any other thoughts you have? I have a question about what were the most important events that happened in the workplace during your career, and I don't know whether there's anything to add to what you've told us, quite a vivid account.
I think I've covered everything. I hope I've answered any of the questions that you wanted or given you a little, at least a bit of information that could be used in some way.
You've given us very useful information. Do you think it's a good idea to preserve the...
Yes, I do. Yes, I do, because it's... in fact, it should be done with quite a number of industries.
Yeah.
Grain handling, paper making, the way that's going, it's...
paper making certainly would be an appropriate...
And sawmills.
Yes. Are there any questions that you think we should have asked that didn't come up? This is also a point at which I very often...
Not really.
My good colleague to ask him whether... Our engineer has any questions?
I remember way back when, once a year, there came out a section of the newspaper, Northwest Business, and Woodside was always brought up, I think, as the second oldest firm in Thunder Bay.
Okay.
And then the first, of course, was the Hudson's Bay Company.
Right.
And then Woodside apparently was the second oldest business. And I remember as a kid driving up and down Carpenter. Pebble Beach, and we drive back into Westward, and there would be this old building even then,
yeah,
or set of buildings at that point, and Woodside on the side. And I guess it was all corrugated steel, or
yes, it was a wood frame with. It was almost like tin.
Yeah,
plates.
A pebble.
Yes, it was a pebbly. I've actually got an oil painting of it, which my wife is not too fond of. But
carried out a little piece of that pebbly steel, but yeah, that brings it to mind.
Now, and I always point out to my kids when we drove down there in the 90s, well, when they were still there, that's the oldest, I always say it was the oldest building in Tennessee, but it wasn't. But I've since found out that that's the second reincarnation or reincarnation of the original building. There was an earlier fire.
There were a number of fires.
Okay.
I believe there's reference to it in the Thunder Bay book, the fires.
All right.
And I've got that book, and
I
don't know where it is.
Morrow?
It's the one that Walter Assaf hated.
Yeah, Morrow's book?
Morrow? The green tree.
Yes,
book.
Yes.
I have that at home. I read that.
And I don't know where I've put it. I've been looking for it the last every 3 months for the last 18 months. I've been looking around, wondering where it went.
I'll pass it to Ernie if you and Ernie pass.
I've got one, but I've got to decide where
I
put it.
You want a particular section copied? I think Michelle's. It may be my copy actually, because I sold my library to my successor, Michelle. I think it's lying on the air conditioning. Vent in the office down the hall there. We can put our head in and just see if it's there.
It might even, I'll have to look on the internet about it.
My one of my friend's fathers had this big map of Port Arthur, and it was done in those days when it was an aerial view.
This isn't the famous 83 or 84.
Right.
Yeah.
And there was Woodside Foundry in one of those little spots there.
Okay.
That's a lovely thing to have.
Yeah.
Who had that?
His name was Don Ballantyne. Was Dr. Ballantyne's father was Dr. Ballantyne of the Port Arthur Clinic, and they have it at their cottage.
Oh, yeah.
It's 2 hours Lake.
Yeah, it's a fine memento of Port Arthur.
But Woodside figured prominently on the show.
Sure,
yeah.
And it was a leading industry given the electricity that was brought in, and so on and so forth. The brothers were marking the path.
You were part of history.
Yes.
A living artifact.
A living artifact.
I guess you referred to memorabilia that you have, a number of things. If there are any things that you would sort of entrust to the project, I think Owen is chief archivist as well. Start in charge of the storeroom. But I'm going to be reconfiguring that. Maybe I should thank you at this point, Peter. It's been splendid. You and I have known each other, of course, for many years. Yes. Maybe I should put on the record the fact that in the 84 campaign, the Epsides, the first, the Mark I version
yes.
of the Epsides for 4x4 plywood painted were
yes.
done by yourself.
Yes,
your
designed
backyard.
And manufactured by me.
So that's 26 years ago. You and I have been acquainted for a long time. Thanks so much.
And I thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.